Polyphonic Press, the podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random. Using the patented random album generator, they are given an album to review from a curated list of over 1,000 classic releases, spanning multiple genres. And now onto the show. Here are your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke.
Welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And the album we're going to be listening to is Brian Eno, Before and After Science.
Okay. Interesting. I don't know what this album comprises of.
Neither do I.
But Brian Eno's generally got some interesting stuff and ideas.
Definitely, yeah. His description of the album says, Before and After Science, released in 1977 by Brian Eno, is one of the most acclaimed solo albums, bridging his experimental rock sensibilities with the ambient style he would soon pioneer. The record is structured almost like two different worlds. The first half is energetic, angular, and rhythm-driven, while the second half drifts into ethereal, meditative territory. On the front side, tracks like No One Receiving and King's Lead Hat showcase Eno's playful, jagged approach to art rock, brimming with quirky rhythms, fractured guitar lines, and off-kilter energy. These songs lean heavily on collaborations with musicians like Robert Fripp, Phil Collins, and members of Can, giving the music a restless, forward-driving feel. The latter half of the album shifts dramatically into silliness and spaciousness. Songs like By This River and Spider and I are hushed, delicate, and hauntingly beautiful, foreshadowing Eno's deep dive into ambient music. The contrast creates a sense of movement from chaos to calm, an arc that mirrors the album's title. Ultimately, Before and After Science stands as a transitional record in Eno's career, mirroring his pop and rock experiments with the serene atmospheres that would define his most influential work. It remains a fan favorite for its balance of accessibility, strangeness, and emotional resonance.
Have you ever heard Can?
No, I don't think so.
At first, they sort of come off as very odd, but they're very interesting. They're a very odd, interesting band from that era. I don't know how else to explain it. It's
well, I guess this will be interesting, that's for sure. So this album was released in December of 1977. The genres are art rock, art pop, avant pop, and experimental pop, and it was released on Island and Polydor Records and produced by Brian Eno and Rhett Davies. And there are 10 songs on the album, and side one and side two is split pretty evenly, 5 and 5. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to take a break at the halfway point after side one and discuss the album at the halfway mark. So if you're listening along, which we do encourage you to do, you can stop it. The album starts with No One Receiving, and side one ends with King's Lead Hat. So if you want to stop it at that point and hear the halfway discussion. And we've linked the album to both Spotify and Apple Music, so you can get the album on your preferred streaming service. And also, just want to remind you to check out our Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress, and you can get lots of cool stuff there. Like, you can get these episodes the day before they go live. You can get a shout out during these episodes, and even pick an album for us to review. So lots of cool stuff to check out there. Okay, here we go. Here is the first song on the album, No One Receiving. Here we go.
All right.
It will shine and it will shatter as I guide it with my rudder on its metal wings. It will it soaring on its metal rays. Nobody passes us in the deep quiet of the dark sky.
All right, and ending side one with King's Lead Hat. Yeah, this is weird, man.
Yeah, it's pretty weird, but I'm actually really digging it.
Yeah, it's reminding me a lot of, I can hear the influence, or I can hear what it influenced. I can hear a lot of new wave, and like Devo and like stuff like that was more, not quite pop, not quite mainstream, but more the artsy side of new wave. That kind of stuff. You can definitely hear. I think that's kind of where he's headed. And I didn't quite realize the influence that he really had on that kind of music.
Yeah. No, it's true. This album is a little more approachable than most of his stuff that I've heard. It's still weird because it's still Brian Eno, but it's definitely got more of a pop sensibility going on with it. But yeah, I can hear elements of like jazz fusion in it, and I can hear, you know, like you said, punk and new wave. There's still a little bit of progressive in it, but it's still all rock and roll.
Yeah. And it's different. Like, it doesn't sound like anything else. Like, it's especially in 77, and you know, it's got like, it's like this frantic energy to it. I don't really know what else to say.
I can hear a lot of industrial, like, too, like, think of like, Depeche Mode or, 9 Inch Nails, stuff like that. Yeah, there's a little bit of that going on. Yeah, I can absolutely hear, you know, the influence of this in that. Yeah, I think this is one of those albums that's probably more important than most people would probably give it credit for. I think it kind of flies under the radar.
Yeah, because, you know, I think at the time, Brian Eno was, I think this is, I don't know what, this is his fifth solo album. But, like, at the time, he was sort of, or may have been more known for being in Roxy Music. And you know, and then he does, goes on this solo adventure. And I don't know how people who are into music, and especially electronic music, cite Brian Eno as a big influence, or maybe not directly influence on them. They know his impact and how important he is in that world. But I don't know at the time, like, how well known he was. Like, was this, like, I don't think that this was like a big radio album or anything like that, but like the musicians, like, obviously if he's getting people like you know, Phil Collins and Robert Fripp to play on it, like, those the musicians know about him. But you know, I don't think you're gonna hear this on, like, definitely not gonna hear it on like top 40 radio or anything like that.
No, and working with the musicians from Can too, it's like throwing it to the other. Like, you've got Robert Fripp and Phil Collins and stuff like that, who are like big names. Although 77, they were still, well, Phil Collins was still with Genesis, I think. Yeah, well, absolutely, he was with Genesis. He joined around that time. Robert Fripp was known for you know, King Crimson and whatnot. Which I can sort of hear hints of that too in this. But yeah, I can sort of hear the band Can as well. The band Can is like really obscure. Like, most people don't know who they are. Well, they're just downright unusual. So you got to hear them to know what I'm talking about. But I think one of their more well-known songs is Father Cannot Yell.
Rain direction down and still your mind, place to the land forever.
and it's definitely sort of a strange sort of a, I don't know, there's a lot of rhythm that sort of leads up to it, and it's sort of a very strange rhythm, and it's really hard to pinpoint exactly what influenced it. I wouldn't even say it was necessarily like African rhythms or anything like that, although that's underneath that, there probably is, but it's, I don't know, you got to hear it to just know what I'm talking about. But when you hear that, you can sort of hear that in this.
Well, what I'm hearing in this, and I don't know exactly his, like, I really don't know a whole lot about Brian Eno, and his process and how he writes and how he comes up with things. But what I'm hearing, and I can only make an estimate based on what I hear, but what I hear is maybe he's like messing around on a synthesizer, or maybe a guitar even, or whatever instrument that he's using. He's just sort of noodling, and then an idea will, like a riff or a series of notes or going up a scale or something, he'll do something, and then he'll think, oh, that's a good idea, and then he'll just build a song around that one idea. And that's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing a lot of, it's not complaint. This sounds like a complaint, but it's not. Is I'm hearing a lot of repetitiveness. And it's sort of like, it's like this one idea, and it's like, okay, I'm building a song around that. And like it's maybe sometimes even just one chord or one note, but it's maybe a specific rhythm. It's just sort of like, I don't want to say it's not lazy, but it's like, it's just whatever. He's not afraid to, he's not working within any boundaries. He's sort of like free to just, okay, this idea, we're going to put like I heard a fretless bass. We're going to put a fretless bass on it, and we're just going to try things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Brian Eno is one of those things who will find an idea, a spark of an idea, in things that most people would throw away as being too out there. He absolutely embraces that. He's, you know, an ugly noise to most people. He would grab onto that and say, oh, that's great. Let's build something with it. And he actually builds something that's, you know, interesting and not even all that unapproachable. I mean, I guess it's probably somewhat unapproachable to some people, but this is probably his most approachable work, but it's still kind of out there.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. I think this may be like, if someone were curious about Brian Eno, this may be like, yeah, listen to this. If you're not used to his stuff, this is maybe a good introduction to him, because it's still you're right, it's still approachable, but it's also a good sort of gateway into his other stuff, more experimental stuff, more experimental than this.
Well, it's like what if you're looking for something that's more like a relaxing thing, and you're used to like ambient music of some sort, then I think probably music for airports wouldn't be that strange upon first hearing, but it definitely was very out there for its time in the very late 70s when it came out, because nobody was doing stuff like that at the time. Yeah, this is still, like I said, it's still rock and roll, but it's got a really, it comes at it from all these different directions and then spreads out in like all these other directions. It takes these strange, you know, it pulls these influences from all sorts of really strange places and then spits out of the other end of it whole new genres.
Yeah, really. I mean, like I was saying, the influence on New Wave, I can't really think of anything before this that sounded like that. I could be wrong, and there's something that I'm not aware of, but I can't think of anything before this that has that energy, that sort of frantic, sort of twitchy energy is the best way I can describe it.
Yeah, twitchy energy. Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's kind of like glam rock, but on it having like a really, I don't know, I guess for lack of a better explanation, on a bad trip or something like that. But it's not unpleasant.
No, at least not to my ears. It's definitely interesting. It's definitely it's not boring at all. That's for sure. But I did manage to find a few interesting facts about the album. It was a long process. Eno worked on the album for almost 2 years, recording around 100 tracks before narrowing it down to the final 10. This careful curation is part of why the record feels so deliberately split between energetic and tranquil halves. And I guess like the second half that we haven't got to yet is the more ambient stuff that that people are used to associating with Brian Eno.
I guess he was sort of doing the same basic idea that David Bowie was with Low in some ways. Because when we were listening to that album, and obviously Brian Eno is all over that, but we know he's all over the second half of it. But even the first half, like I said, it's got that a little bit of that frantic energy, and it came out, I think, the same year.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, the albums are structured very similarly. And yeah, the album is heavy collaboration. The album features an impressive roster of guest musicians, including, like we're saying, Robert Fripp, Phil Collins, then of Genesis, Jackie Liebeszeit, drummer of Can, and Percy Jones, from Brand X. Their contributions give the album its rhythmic diversity and unpredictable textures.
Okay.
And there's a connection to the Talking Heads.
Of course there is.
Yeah. The frantic song King's Lead Hat is actually an anagram for Talking Heads. Eno was beginning his influential collaboration with the band at the time, and the track captures their shared love of jagged, nervous energy. And again, that's the new wave influence that I was thinking of, like the Talking Heads kind of thing.
Yeah.
And like their song "Once in a Lifetime," Brian Eno produced that song, to no surprise. And yeah, he had a big influence on David Byrne and Talking Heads. And by the way, side note, that song was really, it's very odd the way that was put together. The band basically were just jamming in the studio, and they just took snippets of the band's jams and just pieced it together and just faded it in and out. Like that's how that song was put together. So he's got a very interesting mind and in how he can sort of build things.
Yeah. He's doing things that I'd never think to do for sure. And it's sort of interesting because I think that was probably the first time Brian Eno's mindset became a hit.
Yeah, I think so.
Because it is up to that point, I think everything that he did was sort of, for lack of a better term, off-putting to a mainstream audience. But that definitely has a lot of the same energy. I guess maybe it's got sort of softer edges in some places, but it still carries that same sort of frantic energy. But it's a less abrasive, I guess, than say King's Lead Hat.
Yeah, it's more refined, I guess.
And that song came out, what was it, 1979 or 80 or something?
I think it was either 80 or 81. And this is kind of cool. The packaging of the album, the original vinyl edition, came with a set of four offset prints by Peter Schmidt, who was also Eno's collaborator on the Oblique Strategies cards. This turned the record into both a musical and visual art object. I don't know what the Oblique Strategies... Is that another...
I don't know. I'd have to look it up. I think Brian Eno was, again, dabbling in all sorts of different kind of art. He is an artist's artist, be it music or otherwise. He just... Oh, great story about Brian Eno. You know Marcel Duchamp's urinal?
Yep.
Well, he went into a museum, I don't know exactly where, it was probably in New York or something like that, and he saw... you know, what's probably not the original urinal, but it was Marcel Duchamp's urinal marked R. Mutt. And he thought, just this is the way his brain works, because the entire idea of that urinal was like, I could basically put a urinal up into a gallery and they'll accept it if I present it a certain way, which was Marcel Duchamp sort of a thumbing his nose up to the art establishment. Brian Eno walks into the gallery, sees this urinal, and says, somebody needs to take a piss in there. So he did.
So he did. Yeah, of course. Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not? quickly, the Oblique Strategies, I don't have time to read the whole thing, but apparently it's a card-based method for promoting creativity, jointly created by musician Brian Eno and multimedia artist Peter Schmidt, first published in 1975. Physically, it takes the form of a deck of 7 by 9 centimeter printed cards in a black box. Each card offers a challenging constraint intended to help artists, particularly musicians, break writer's block by encouraging lateral thinking. So it's basically like a inspirational sort of phrases on cards. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, couldn't hurt. And the last one is the transition to ambient music. The serene closing tracks, especially By This River and Spider and I, foreshadow Eno's groundbreaking ambient series, which began the following year with Music for Airports. In this sense, the album marks a pivotal turning point in his career. So yeah, so this is like the transition to his ambient, yeah,
straight up ambient stuff, yeah, which again is really interesting. It's not for everybody. It certainly didn't go over well when he actually played it in airports, because people didn't know what to make of it. I kind of get the idea, because I've been in places, especially like brutalist architecture, and you kind of want a certain, I don't know, it evokes a certain feeling, and not everybody likes it, but I kind of do. I don't know, it's sort of melancholic, and his music sort of reflects that sort of an atmosphere, but I think for a lot of people, they try to get away from that as much as possible. I think it probably frightens some people, maybe.
Well, especially if you're stressed and, you know, you're in the airport trying to get to your gate, and that's kind of the last thing you want to hear.
Yeah, it's true. Like, if you're, you know, an airport is not necessarily, or a bus station, or, you know, which is like follow-up albums and stuff like that would be, you know, people are living their lives in these places and don't necessarily want, they're not really engrossed in the artistic expression of the environment that they're in. And they don't want somebody to suck them into that thing if they're, again, stressed about something.
Well, yeah, it just reminds me of, there was, I can't remember the what comedian was talking about it, but they were talking about one of their early gigs that they got into, and like when they were just first starting out. And one of the gigs was in a Chinese restaurant, but nobody told any of the patrons of the restaurant that a comedy show was about to happen. So it's like they were just like trying to have their dinner, and ladies and gentlemen, like nobody knew this was gonna, and it was like just bad, just like not the right environment. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's true for especially like a comedy show. Nobody wants a comedy show to break out around them. People have to kind of get themselves in the mood to want to go to a comedy show. It's just something about comedy shows. It's a very deliberate mindset that you have to put yourself into.
So those were some interesting facts about the album. But I guess we'll get back into the second side of the album. But before we do that, let's hear from our friends over at the Album Nerds podcast. So check those guys out. Here we go.
Drop the Needle on the Album Nerds podcast.
It's just the Album Nerds.
Just Album Nerds.
Join Andy, Don, and Dude each week as they discuss albums from themes chosen by the Wheel of Musical Discovery.
Heavy metal guitar virtuosos.
Double albums.
MTV Raps.
Punk rock.
The top 10 albums of 1986.
Uncover hidden gems, revisit classics, and hear fresh takes on your favorite records.
Exile on Main Street.
Some of what country music can do best is that storytelling.
This is a messy album, for sure.
I just want to hear Floyd in everything, I think.
Born in the USA.
And it sounds great overall as an album. I'm just not like moved by it.
The Album Nerds Podcast. Three guys talking music. Give it a spin wherever you find podcasts and albumnerds.com.
We'll now take a few seconds before we begin side two.
Come on,
thank you. Here's side two.
Ending the album with Spider and I. The second half was interesting with the more ambient stuff. It's not exactly like what Brian Eno would do in the future, but it's like you can definitely hear the transition.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, that last song, The Spider and I, reminded me a lot of like Pink Floyd.
Yes, actually, yeah. Now that you mention it, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, something like in the middle of one of their albums or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's another like influence. I don't know whether it's probably a little bit of both where, you know, Pink Floyd probably influenced Brian Eno and then, you know, probably influenced Pink Floyd again for like, especially when you think about what Pink Floyd would do in the 80s and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. It's funny, and I when we did that Kraftwerk album, that's what, maybe 2 years ago at this point. It is funny, like what I was like saying about that was, and I can hear it too, is hearing like future, what the future of music would be, and you can definitely hear a lot of influence on what the 80s would sound like in this album. Like I was saying, and not just new wave that I was saying earlier, like even the second half, like a lot of the advances in technology, for better or worse, basically laid out the landscape of what the 80s would sound like. And you can definitely hear the, even the more pop stuff, you can hear the influence that it was influenced by the second side of this album. Like maybe like new wave was the first half, and then like the sort of more synth pop, more mellow stuff is like the second half.
Yeah. No, it's true. Yeah, all roads lead to Brian Eno. I don't know. in one way or another, it seems to be like he had a huge influence on, you know, what music would become after he basically stuck his fingers in all the pies to, you know, kind of do what he wanted to do. And that's honestly what he was doing. He was just doing what he wanted to do, whether or not people would listen to it or not. It's just, he had ideas.
Oh, exactly. And you know, not just for him, but like producing other artists as well. And, you know, the work that he did with like another shaping the music of the 80s and teaming up with Daniel Lanois and producing U2. They did a couple of albums with U2, the two of them. So yeah, his influence is huge, not just for the future, but in the present. or at least, you know, like when that music was current, like when you like did the Joshua Tree and all that. But yeah, but this album I think it's not just the turning point in Brian Eno's career, but like it seems like music in general. at least for a little bit, for about 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, things were definitely changing fast during this, you know, during the transition from like your progressive rock into your meat and potatoes punk rock. Yeah, there was still other like, you know, micro genres going on, and this seems to be right smack dab in the middle of all that changeover, and it had to have influenced it one way or another. I think a lot of people just were into what he was doing.
Well, yeah, like I think this is literally in the middle because this album has people like Phil Collins and Robert Fripp, who were at the time very much in the progressive rock world. But then also you have a reference to the Talking Heads, which was like the punk new wave world. And so this is like you were saying, this is literally right in the middle of that. It's sort of like Brian Eno was the nucleus of all music from the 70s, from the first half of the decade and the second half.
Yeah, he just seemed to have been in the right place at the right time, and quite literally, didn't matter where he was, it was, you know, music was just changing around him, and he was changing it. Whether he was trying to change it or not, it's just, I don't think he cared one way or the other. He just wanted to do what he did. But he wound up, you know, influencing so many people in all sorts of different genres.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what the best, that's what the most influential people do, is they just do what they do naturally. You know, whether it's like the old blues artists, pick any influential artist. They weren't trying to create a genre. They did, but they weren't trying to. They were just doing what they did naturally. So all of that being said, what would be your three highlights on the album?
Oh, that's actually really tough. Oh, it is really tough. I liked Energy Fools the Magician. I think that was like the first of the it was in the first half of the album, but I think that was the first one that sort of touched on the ambient energy of the album. I liked it, but I also liked the song Backwater. I thought that was pretty good. Kig's Lead Hat. Oh, man, it's kind of hard to pick. I think I'm going to pick those three, though. I think those are probably my favorites.
Yeah, I think mine is probably Kig's Lead Hat. Yeah, Backwater as well. And I really liked the closing track, Spider and I. I do like the Pink Floyd sort of influence on that. So yes, I guess that brings us to the question is, would you listen to this album again?
I think so. I think if I saw this somewhere, I'd pick it up.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, that's a good point. It's like if it's in a record store somewhere and I'm just browsing and it's like, oh yeah, that's a good one, and I'll pick that up. Yeah, I would definitely listen to this again. I think I think I would have to be in the right mood for it, but I think it would be...
Could be.
It would be easy to get into that mood. Like, some of the albums that we talk about are like, yeah, I could listen to this again, but I would have to be in the right mood for it. I think I am more often than not in the right mood for it, but it's definitely a mood record.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I sort of feel the same way. It's yeah, for me, it wouldn't be hard to be in the right mood for this. I don't know. I seem to be lately in the mood for stuff like this quite often, so it actually kind of hits me in just the right spot. So yeah, it's actually quite good.
Yeah, so I guess we'll end the episode there. Thank you so much for listening if you made it this far. We would love to hear from you. We'd love to get some feedback. You can do that by going to the website. Go to polyphonicpress.com and you can go to the contact page there, and as well as get all the past episodes that we've done. And definitely, if this is your first time listening, give the show a follow and leave a rating and review, because it really helps listeners find us. And you can, like I said, check out the Patreon. There's lots of cool stuff there if you feel inclined. And I think that just about does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.